welcome to Albion Narrations. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. Today's narration is part 3 of Plantation Life Before Emancipation. Chapter 8. Daddy Jack, a Curious Character. I wish I had the genius of a Dickens, so skilful in portraying life among the lowly that I might do justice to the odd creature whose name heads this letter. I suppose that he must have been born, most people are, although I do not remember having ever heard of his parents. Kindred he seemed to have none, neither brother nor sister, uncle, aunt nor cousin, but he was one all to himself. A glance at his face would have convinced you that if ever the slightest strain of white blood mingled with the African current, it must have effected a junction with it before the confusion of tongues at Babel, when, as some ethnologists suppose, a diversity of races was miraculously produced. When I first recollected him, he had attained to middle life. Daddy, the title of respect low country children of Georgia were taught to give every elderly manservant, Daddy Jack was a queer negro. For example, he was mostly a bachelor. Single blessedness was so uncommon among the slaves, and for a reason already mentioned, the absolute ensiness and certainty of the support of a family, that I now recall but two bachelors in my large acquaintance among them, and one of these, I learned last summer in a visit to my native county, had finally surrendered to the charms of the other sex, and, I believe, died in the yoke. Daddy Jack was a Benedict once, and for a short time. How it happened, I am not able to say. Whether it was leap year or not, I am not advised, but Mom Nanny, a widow, ensnared him. My impression is she did most, if not all, of the courting, and the all-prevailing argument was her ability to cook a nice pot of hominy, or better still, a savoury mess of rice, and skilfully to bake a hoe cake. Their honeymoon must have been a tempestuous one, for as the negroes were accustomed to express it, they divided blankets, perhaps before the next full of the moon. Nor was this to be wondered at, for he was like Rip Van Winkle, a shiftless, good-natured fellow, but unlike him, full of oddities that did not minister to a wife's comfort. He was at once the idlest and the most industrious slave on the plantation. Indolent where his own interests were concerned, but active where his master's were affected. I recall now the report of one of my dusky playmates of what he had just seen and heard, and in his lingo. As I been gwine long de street, and pass Bur Jack House, I yeddy somebody de whistle, and I look in de door, and I see Bur Jack a-sittin' on de jice, and pulling down de shingles to make de fire wid. Most of our readers have heard of the Arkansas traveller who, accosting a man playing on his fiddle beside the door of his ruined cabin with the question, "Friend, why don't you mend your roof?" receives, the bow suspended only for a minute for the purpose, this answer, "When the sun shines, I don't need to, and when it rains, I can't." Daddy Jack made the leaks with his own hand, and ran the risk of a wetting to ensure a warning. From the same authority I also learned that a straw hat which my father had given him had been used by the improvident fellow in kindling the fire. My father had a great fondness for him, and gave him 2 suits of clothing where the rest received 1, and a blanket every year instead, as was common every alternate year, but as he was unaccustomed to the use of thimble and needle, and generally had no wife or sister to mend for him, his clothing was not always presentable. His newest blanket was speedily in holes from a habit he had. In his room, parlour, chamber and kitchen all in one, I do not remember to have seen any sleeping accommodation. I doubt if he ever undressed and went regularly to bed. His habit was to rake aside the fire coals and then spread his blanket upon the ashes of the hearth, where he could feel its grateful warmth. Whether he temporarily altered his sleeping habits upon the advent of his bride, we cannot say, but I think it doubtful. I have read of some race that by a singular inconsistency are nice about their persons, but not cleanly about their clothing. Our friend, perhaps, never washed his garments, and he had no female friend to do it for him, but he was a diligent bather. At midnight in midwinter, he would divest himself of all his clothing and plunge into the calf hole, an excavation made to contain water for the younger cattle. Almost too idle to cook his own food, he would, as my playmates laughingly said, work all day for one spoonful of hominy. I have often heard him at the handmill, long before I, an early riser, was up, grinding corn for some trifling reward. My father gave him, as he did the rest of the people, a piece of good land to cultivate in rice, of which he was as fond as any Chinaman, and provided the seed. Well, he had to order the driver to flog him to make him turn up the soil, and then he defeated the master's kind design by beating out the rice and planting his plot with the chaff. I never knew him to be sick for a day, and he was never behindhand in his tasks, and never punished for idleness where his master's work was concerned. Withal, Daddy Jack was a professing Christian, and called himself a Presbyterian. But as like as not, he had not the first conception what the word meant, except that it signalised the fact that he once jined Midway Church and not Newport the Baptist, and had been sprinkled and not dipped. He was no doubt regular in attendance upon plantation prayers, and sung loudly, when not asleep, and sometimes when he was, and was always in his place at church, especially Sacrament Sunday. Daddy Jack had a profound conviction of the reality of both heaven and hell. He was very sure two people of his acquaintance were bound for the better of the two, Old Miss and Mass William. He knew their calling and election by this token, the generous plates of victuals they were accustomed to send the faithful servant from their tables. Perhaps he had scriptural ground for this persuasion, for he was not one of the little ones to whom the cup of cold water or its more valued cup of hot coffee was given in the name of a disciple, and one of the hungry brethren whom they had fed and concerning whom the master would say, "Inasmuch as ye have done it unto one of the least of these, my brethren, ye have done it unto me." The death of my honoured parents, the one scarcely disturbed in her last hours by the guns of Fort Sumter, the other after a few weeks on the next national anniversary, following the companion of 50 years' happy wedded life into the beyond, caused a division of property, and Daddy Jack passed to one of my married sisters in the same county. The war went on, and I removed to a distant part of the state, and after it to Louisiana, and so I lost sight of Daddy Jack for a time, but I hope some day to meet the dear old shiftless, good-natured, harmless fellow in the better land, where all that was defective in his organisation and character will have been removed. Recently I heard a coloured bishop of the Methodist Church exclaim in an earnest address, "Some ask, will we have the same colour in heaven we have had on earth?" This I do not care to know. All I wish is to make sure of getting there, and not being barely saved, but going sweeping through the gates. We cannot tell what changes will be effected at the resurrection in the bodies of the saved, but some of the whitest souls I have ever known dwelled in the blackest of skins. Perhaps, and if some commentators are correct, certainly if colour as well as servitude was a part of the curse denounced upon Canaan for the sin of Ham, it will be changed. But this we do know, that nothing will sever the chain of holy love which in heaven will forever bind heart to heart and all to the God of love. For hear the beloved John, "After this I beheld, and lo, a great multitude whom no man could number, of all nations and kindreds and tongues, stood before the throne and before the Lamb, clothed with white robes and palms in their hands." And to him the angel makes answer concerning them, "These are they which came out of great tribulation, and have washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb." Chapter 9. Folklore of the Negro. Folklore, transmitted orally from sire to son, constituted the only literature of the Negro slave, who, as a rule, was unacquainted with the alphabet of his master. Here I hope I may be permitted, in accordance with the general spirit and tenor of these letters, which are designedly and largely the testimony of one who narrates what he has seen and heard, to recall some childhood experiences. Before we were considered old enough to attend evening religious services, we children were left at home in charge of the house servants, who were accustomed to entertain us by the relation of Negro fables. Not a few Southern writers, notably our own Ruth McHenry Stewart, have, in the field of fiction, correctly portrayed both Negro character and dialect. The author named with a pathos and sympathy with her lowly subjects, which often exacts from those who knew the Negro before emancipation, the involuntary tribute of tears. But only two of them have wrought in the rich field of the Negro folklore, Joel Chandler Harris and Charles C. Jones, Jr. The fables related by these last-mentioned writers were, in the main, those recounted at the planter's fireside to the never-weary youthful auditors. With Joel Chandler Harris's recitals, the thousands of the readers of The Century have been made familiar in the narratives of Uncle Remus. Not so many have perused the account of them in a little book from the press of Houghton, Mifflin and Company, entitled Negro Myths from the Georgia Coast Told in the Vernacular by Charles C. Jones, Jr. Reared in the same community with the latter author, I desire to testify to its literal accuracy in story and dialect. There is not a particle of fiction in either. I learned from him that they were taken down from the lips of old Negroes in Liberty County, Georgia. The dedication of this little volume is characteristic, but will be no surprise to those who had any knowledge of domestic service in the South before emancipation. In memory of Montevideo Plantation, and of the family servants whose fidelity and affection contributed so materially to its comfort and happiness. Let me again bear my testimony, as one who was by marriage a frequent visitor, and for weeks at a time a fortunate resident beneath the roof which sheltered the apostle to the blacks, and the author who, as his eldest born, bears his father's honoured name in one of those typical southern homes in which polish and culture were combined with piety, to the fact that these family servants were all that the dedication of their once young master portrays them to have been. Between these stories of two authors, there is, as might have been expected, some sameness, as they were conscientious workers in the same general field, but a perceptible variation in their versions and dialect, due to the fact that they wrought in different parts of it, Mr. Harris giving the dialect and folklore of the Negroes of Middle Georgia, and Mr. Jones those of the Negroes of the coasts of Georgia and of South Carolina. As the seaboard was first settled and supplied with African labour, it is evident that the fables preserved and recorded by the latter author have the preference as the originals. I have, in my partial investigations, been astonished to find how far these fables have spread into the interior, and how with natural and in some instances most amusing variations they have been transmitted by tradition with substantial correctness. President George J. Ramsey of Silliman Collegiate Institute, Clinton, Louisiana, tells me that in the last years of the war, he as a child heard Uncle Remus fables in East Virginia, and our servant man, who was a federal soldier in the war, gives me substantially the story of the tar baby at the well as told in Negro myths, but with a laughable variation in its ending, perhaps a Louisiana edition. And I will not now, from the 57 originals collected by Charles C. Jones, Jr., give the two specimens provided, because I just cannot do the black dialect correctly. It just sounds terrible. These stories are almost entirely and purely fables. That is, narratives in which animals are endowed with speech. Only to a very limited degree do human beings figure in them. They are never, except in the remotest sense, religious, and seldom, if ever, rise above the level of the ethics of Benjamin Franklin's proverbs. If any criticism is proper from a moral standpoint, I should say that they, or some of them, glorify cunning and falsehood, at the expense of honesty and truth, but in such a way that we cannot but laugh at the story, while we withhold our admiration from its teachings. It is also a curious fact that, for whatever reason we are at a loss to say, the rabbit is the embodiment of smartness and not the fox. The Anglo-Saxon's model of cunning, and who, by the way, in the story quoted, is outwitted by the squirrel. The literary world is greatly indebted to the two Georgia authors named for rescuing from the incoming tide of oblivion, which is fast obliterating all that was peculiar in the past civilization of a people who were the innocent cause of the bloodiest and most transforming war of modern times. For, strange to say, and I now speak from the testimony of the author of The Negro Myths, who found much reluctance in communicating them, and from my own observation in the case of a Negro woman whom I had raised, that not only are the new ideas engendered by freedom supplanting this folklore, but the religion, as now taught among them by their coloured preachers, is setting itself against their narration as sinful. They did not perceptibly harm the morals of Southern children, black or white, and were infinitely preferable to the blood-curdling ghost stories which some nurses terrify the young with in our day. They are certainly, in the matter of injurious influence, not to be compared to the dime novels to which the almost universal acquisition of the art of reading gives our young Africans unrestricted access. Chapter 10. Old Midway, a typical church. It was remarked in a previous letter that the southern churches, with a few exceptions, had a mixed membership. That is, they were composed of whites and blacks, and the whole being under the government of the former. In this respect, the Midway Church was a typical church. It had a membership of perhaps 500, about three-quarters of whom were Negroes. The church edifice, which was situated in Liberty, one of the seaboard counties of Georgia, 30 miles southwest of Savannah, was called Midway because equidistant between the two great rivers, the Savannah and the Latimer. It was central to a very rich but malarial region whose original growth was cane, oak, hickory and cypress. Bearing in colonial times the name of St. John's Parish, the county received by legislative enactment shortly after the Revolution the honourable title of Liberty, in commemoration of its plucky conduct in taking decided measures to join the other colonies in their revolt when the Provincial Council of Georgia had refused to unite with them. It is a remarkable and noteworthy fact that a county which perhaps never had more than between 2,000 or 3,000 whites had thus the honour of contributing two signatures to that immortal document, the Declaration of Independence, Lyman Hall and Button Gwinnett. Made rudely acquainted in earlier times with the torch and tomahawk of the savage, it was her destiny in the Revolution, as more recently in our Civil War, to know the baptism of fire and blood. Colonel Prevost of the British Army burned the rice in stacks and some of the houses of the planters, and reduced to ashes the sacred edifice in which they had worshipped the god of their fathers. General Screven was killed not far from the church site. Colonel McIntosh, one of her gallant sons who commanded the small earthen redoubt protecting her flourishing little seaport of Sunbury at the mouth of the Midway, to the demand of Colonel Fuser of unconditional surrender, returned the laconic reply, "Come and take it," an invitation finally and prudently declined by the commander of His Majesty's forces. When Washington visited Georgia in 1791, the Congregational Church and Society at Midway presented to him a patriotic address, to which the father of his country made a fitting and handsome reply. This early and ardent espousal of the cause of the revolting colonies by the Church and Society of Midway is perhaps to be accounted for by the naturally strong ties which still bound them to New England. Their ancestors came from Britain to secure liberty of worship and first settled not far from what is now the city of Boston at an Indian town, which in honour of the native place of some of the settlers and of a cherished minister they called Dorchester. 60 years afterwards, their descendants, largely influenced by religious motives, moved as a church with their pastor, the Reverend Joseph Lord, a Congregational minister, to South Carolina and settled on the Ashley River about 18 miles above Charleston. This settlement they also called Dorchester. After a residence of more than 50 years, finding their lands impoverished and insufficient for themselves and descendants, and somewhat discouraged by their continued unhealthiness, they again emigrated in a body, under their pastor and officers, to Georgia, and effected a settlement in a district at the headwaters of the Midway and Newport Rivers, two short tidewater streams draining what is now known as Liberty County. Coming to this wild country as a church, they secured from the colonial government a large tract of land, compactly situated, and by articles of agreement, the colonists pledged themselves not to alienate any of their land to outsiders, save with the unanimous consent of the society. They speedily built a neat church, or meeting house, as it is called in the records, at the cross paths, at a point central to the settlement. Their first pastor, at least, was a Congregational minister, and the government of the church somewhat peculiar. It was not purely congregational, for the control of church matters was not in the hands of the whole society, but of a session composed of all the male members without respect to age. Their officers were deacons, and a body of select men, as they were called. Every year the church went through the routine of electing a pastor. Retaining this nondescript form of church government down to our late war, the church has from early times been served by Presbyterian ministers only, and its members have always regarded themselves as Presbyterians. Puritan by ancestry, they were a preeminently godly people. First in their estimation was the church, and next the schoolhouse. The Sabbath was strictly observed. One of the church officers was also Justice of the Peace. Should some traveller attempt to pass on the Lord's Day with his wagons and teams on the public highway running by the church, he was, by this zealous administrator of law, human and divine, peremptorily halted, but then taken home with him, and freely and most hospitably entertained, he and his beasts, and on Monday sent on his way rejoicing, with a hearty Godspeed. The Westminster Assembly's shorter catechism was diligently taught in all its families. Celebrating some time before the late war its centennial, this remarkable church, not to exhaust the roll call of its worthies, has furnished more than one theological professor, such as Reverend Doctors Thomas Golding and C.C. Jones, 40 ministers of the gospel, not a few of whom have been eminent for their talents and piety, for example, Reverend Dr. Daniel Baker, a number of distinguished physicians and college professors, not a few of them known in the scientific world, as for instance Dr. Joseph Jones of New Orleans and the brothers Leconte of California. It has given eminent men to the bar, such as Judge Law, late of Savannah, Colonel C.C. Jones of Augusta, Georgia, and others. It has supplied teachers by the hundred, and has trained, only the judgment can reveal how many, a multitude of saved sinners for heaven, and by her liberal gifts of means and of men, like Way and Quarterman, to foreign missions, has helped to extend the kingdom of our Lord and Saviour in the world. The war wrote fini on the last page of this remarkable and honourable history. The changed relations of master and servant have consolidated the blacks in this region and scattered the whites into the remoter and healthier parts of the country. A coloured Presbyterian church under a white pastor, and in connection with the Northern Assembly, are now the only worshippers in the sacred edifice that was built in 1790. It is now, by permission of the descendants of the white members, used by the Negroes, upon the easy terms of keeping in good order the adjacent graveyard, in which repose the ashes of four or five godly generations. It is a church with a finished history, but as her sons and daughters, inheriting the sterling piety of their fathers, gather annually upon this hallowed ground to lovingly commemorate the historic past, they illustrate in their own persons, characters, and celebration the blessed fact that the gracious influences set in motion by an earnest Christian church continue, even when in the providence of God, it as an organization has become extinct. and the history of this venerable church, so briefly sketched by one of her loyal and loving sons, it seems to him, is but a providential comment upon these sweet words of Moses. Know therefore that the Lord thy God, he is God, the faithful God, which keepeth covenant and mercy with them that love him and keep his commandments for 1,000 generations. In our next letter, we shall attempt to draw from memory a picture of Sacrament Sunday in the Old Midway Church. Thank you very much for listening, and watch out for more episodes in Plantation Life Before Emancipation.